Hello and welcome to season two of the Ecocentrics. I'm Tom.
And I'm PK. And this week we're going to discuss the 1.5 Celsius limit.
So what is the 1.5 limit?
And what happens if we exceed it?
It's a massive subject.
As an American, Tom, do you think I can accurately understand what Celsius is?
I do wonder if that's going to be a challenge throughout this episode.
So you may have read the headline a few weeks ago that global warming is set to break the 1.5 limit for the first time.
Yeah, there's a report completed which showed that there is a 66% chance that global average temperature will breach the 1.5 degree Celsius limit for only 1 year. So it doesn't actually mean we've gone over that critical 1.5 degrees threshold, because that's an average temperature. But it does show that actually we're really moving towards the danger zone, so to speak, in terms of climate change now. And so it's a 66% chance that by 2027, that we will have gone over 1.5 for at least 1 year. I don't know, PK, if you saw any of the coverage on the day of it at all.
Yeah, it was, well, one, when I saw the headline, it was really sort of scary. And then reading down into it and being from the southeast of the United States, or having spent, you know, a good chunk of time in Florida and Georgia, the El Nino weather system can wreak havoc on all of those states in that area. So it was fascinating to sort of read in and dive in and understand that how that can impact the global average temperature.
So El Nino is basically, to put it into simple terms, you have the El Nino and the La Nina effects in the South Pacific. And these are to do with the ocean currents down there. But in terms of why it matters for climate change, is during an El Nino event, the ocean basically gives off loads more heat. So it makes the average temperature warmer during an El Nino event. So for example, during 2016, temperatures, we had a major El Nino event, and temperatures were 0.2 degrees higher than expected without an El Nino event. So they can be major driving forces in actually changing the temperature on a year-by-year basis. And vice versa, La Nina years make things slightly cooler. But the thing that blew my mind on the day of this coverage, I'm an avid Radio 4 listener. That shows my personality well there. So I listened to the 1 p.m. news on Radio 4, and it covered really well, has some really important information on it. By the 5 p.m. slot, it wasn't even being talked about. It just wasn't on the agenda.
Wow.
The reason why for that day is because there was that Harry and Meghan car chase incident. And don't get me wrong, I'm glad everyone's okay. But like, this is a major, major issue for like human civilization as we know it. And it didn't even stay as the main headline for the day for a whole day. We just pinned it after 4 hours because something else came out. Like, it just shows how we just don't understand the gravity of this challenge yet, and all the things that we need to do around it. And we can kind of just be like, oh, we'll push this one to the side because something else has come up that's more important for our quick news cycle. For some of us as well, like, I'm sure you weren't actually too surprised by this, PK, were you? In reality, we've kind of known this is going to come.
I think most of us have known it was going to come before 2030. You know, 2030 was like a stretch target, and really a sort of an inaccessible stretch target.
Yeah.
If you want, I think we should maybe dive in a little bit to the history of why we got into 1.5.
So basically, during 2015, we had this landmark agreement in terms of climate change, something that most of us are probably somewhat familiar with, which was the Paris Climate Accord or the Paris Climate Agreement. And within this, it compelled all of the nations involved, so 193 nations, to really try to keep temperatures well below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, but then critically to pursue efforts to limit temperature increases to above 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. This is where the idea of 1.5 started to come from. It's in the language of the text, and it was seen as something that was important at the time, but following on from this, the United Nations commissioned a piece of work to be done by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC. And they're the people that release all those really scary reports that come out all the time. And I say all the time, they've actually finished for a little while now, so there won't be another one for about 5 years. They were asked to do this specialist report looking at the difference between 1.5 and 2 degree warmer world and understand, okay, actually, how important is it that we aim for 1.5, or is 2 degrees sufficient? And as you can probably guess by the fact we will talk about 1.5, they realize things get quite bad if you go over that number. And it's important for us to really try and pursue these efforts to keep 1.5 alive, so to speak, in terms of making sure we don't cross that critical threshold.
Yeah. And I think before that, what ended up happening through a lot of this research and going back and forth was something called the Alliance of the Small Island States. The Alliance of Small Island States essentially said, look, we're small islands. If you want us to agree to a 2-degree increase in trying to mitigate those, many of our islands, it's pretty much a death sentence. And that is the exact words of Mia Mottley, who was the Prime Minister of Barbados at the time. 2 degrees is a death sentence. So after some more research and some negotiations, it was brought down to 1.5, recognizing that at 1.5, definitely some islands are going to be heavily impacted and might disappear. So because of that, that's what the Paris Climate Agreement agreed upon. It was understood if we put the cap at 2 degrees, we're essentially consigning all of these small islands to a death knell.
Yeah, there's actually an amazing documentary. I'll put it in the show notes, all about the Paris Climate Agreement and actually how, and some of the role of small island developing nations and also indigenous folk in promoting some of these really ambitious targets. It's really interesting to actually see the role that a few people have had in this kind of discussion and framing this around 1.5. But I think what's really important within this is to say that 1.5 isn't just a cliff edge. We don't get to 1.5 degrees and just drop off the face of the Earth. Everything doesn't fall apart immediately. There is incremental impacts as we go further and further over this limit. 1.5 is going to be devastating already. It's just how much more devastating do we want to go? Because, for example, in the IPCC report, they look at several kind of key ecosystems, which are important. Going over only 1 degree, some things like warm water corals are going to get decimated. But then 1.5, things like Arctic regions are going to be more and more impacted by climate change. But then actually between 1.5 and 2 degrees, terrestrial ecosystems will start to be destabilized. So it's not 1.5 is this, if we go beyond it, we all give up hope. It's really important that we make sure that, okay, even if we get to go to 1.5, we need to try and stop things at 1.6, 1.7, 1.8. And that's a really important message within this, because I think the framing of 1.5 as a cliff edge is sometimes a bit dangerous as well.
Especially considering the news now, if people go, well, we're already going to reach it at least once this year, so why should we even try? You sort of get the paralysis and inaction. So I think the real message, every bit of slowing and reducing warming is critical. So 1.7 is worse than 1.6 on so many levels. The more we can decrease that rise in temperature, the better it'll be, regardless of what the temperature is.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to say that this isn't a global average temperature. One of the things I think gets confused quite a lot in this is that 1.5 degrees is going to be 1.5 degrees everywhere. It means me sat in Stoke is going to be on average 1.5 degrees warmer on average, and that's not the case at all. There's so much variability across different parts of the world in terms of the impact of warming. So, for example, the oceans will warm at a much slower rate and warm less, whereas the land warms much quicker. So reaching 1.5 degrees will probably see land surface temperatures increase by an average 2.4 degrees. And some specific parts of the land, so particularly in the polar regions, will see warming much, much greater than that. And actually already in some polar regions, we've seen warming of 2 degrees. Because of the feedback effects that work up there. As the ice melts, the area becomes darker and it absorbs more heat, and there's greater heating in those areas. So this isn't just one homogenous figure which comes across the whole world, 1.5. Each place is different, and each place is going to warm by a different degree, even if the world average is 1.5 degrees.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to make. The polar regions that are heating up the fastest, and that's bad because as that heats up, we lose that wonderful reflective system called ice that usually reflects the sun's heat out back into the sky. So we reduce ice mass, we reduce that reflective system. It's just, it's almost like a snake eating its own tail. It just gets getting worse and worse.
I've never heard the analogy drawn between the ice albedo feedback loop and a snake eating its own tail.
Well, now you have, Tom. I have something really interesting, Tom, that is about 1.5. that I hadn't come across before. And there was a pilot project done by an institute in Berlin. So a specific writer, he's a researcher. His name is Lloyd Alter, and he writes for various organizations, a journalist, but he's a researcher as well. And he participated. It's a very, very small pilot project, but it was sort of fascinating. A pilot project to see if these individuals could live within a daily emissions budget of 1.5 degrees. Have you heard about this?
No, but it's going to be really interesting. There's something called the 200 watt lifestyle, which is similar.
The 200 watt lifestyle. I love that. I'm writing that down. Yeah. So this pilot project, granted, there's all sorts of caveats we have to understand about that. But I do think what's interesting is when you do with these pilot projects, just understanding what are the issues individuals have. And granted, one of the things they noted was, again, this feels like it's putting it on the individual to take action. And that's been sold to us by fossil fuel organizations. However, what can come out of this is you can see where the challenges are an individual would have to try to live in a 1.5 degree lifestyle. And then we know the systems or the areas where we might need to make changes, such as transportation. So from that can come some good information. So Lloyd ended up working with Kate Power of Hot or Cold Institute in Berlin, which is this amazing group of talented people on this pilot project. Participants around the world, so that's nice. You had diversity. Try to live a 1.5 degree lifestyle for an entire month. They had a spreadsheet, which was pretty basic, but other researchers have created more elaborate versions, which anyone can use. So we'll link into the in the show notes for that. And sort of these ingenious ways of calculating these carbon emissions for everything. And what they ended up discovering was the 4-week real-world pilot project had 16 participants, and 11 of them were able to live within the daily emissions budget of 1.5. And they had three hypotheses. So one hypothesis was that most of these participants were already able to live within a 2030 range because of their location, their education, and their lifestyle. They also, many of them also knew a lot about 1.5. So they might have already had reductions that sort of gave them a head start. This particular individual, Lloyd, found that transportation can break the bank. So driving a car is inconsistent with having a 1.4 degree lifestyle. And all of the participants agreed with that. Their second hypothesis was that 1.5 degrees Celsius lifestyle requires learning and adaptation, but can actually be enjoyable and actually resulted in healthier ways of living. And I think this is what you and I have emphasized to a lot of people as well. In our way of living now, where we consume, 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 it's actually not necessarily bringing us a lot of happiness. So not only is it causing environmental impacts and impacts to biodiversity, it's actually making us spend more money. We're not having as much money as we used to. We're spending it on things that actually have been proven to not drive human happiness. And also, we're not engaging in things that will correlate to positive happiness as well, such as walking more for, you know, getting more physical exercise, being outside more, spending less, engaging with humans more. So that's what they found. Another hypothesis, the last one they came up with, was systematic barriers are the biggest perceived challenge for long-lasting emissions reductions by individuals. A lot of that had to do with specific things like travel or issues around mobility. Also with food, housing, and energy, some people might not be able to adjust their energy as much as they could or install energy efficiencies, but people could do it. But again, it did showcase where some of the barriers are.
No, I think that's really, really interesting, in terms of actually looking at what life would be like. And I know just for a context within this, for us to be compatible with a 1.5 degree future, the globe needs to peak emissions by 2025, and we need to have 43% emissions reduction by 2030, with net zero by 2050. At the moment, we're on track for around a 10% rise in emissions by 2030, so we're nowhere near that. And what that means for individuals is that actually our carbon footprints need to be something around the region of 2.1 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent by 2030 compared to where they are today. And in the UK, our carbon footprints kind of vary from maybe 5 on the really low end all the way up to more like 12 to 15, depending on your livelihood. So I think that, yeah, it shows there's a long, long way to go with that. And I think something you said at the end there is really interesting about the systemic issues and the challenges we face. So I'm doing a piece of research at the moment looking at the non-technical barriers to decarbonisation within our region. And it's really interesting because actually we always talk about technical solutions to these problems. We talk about electric vehicles, we talk about solar panels, we talk about batteries, we talk about all these things that we need to do. But digging into all the non-technical barriers that exist, things around kind of skills and capacity, governance within local communities, finance fundamentally, actually, these are so much harder to fix than how people get an electric car. But also, they're the mechanisms between how we actually do those things as well. I was in a room a few weeks ago. There was an electric car charging company there, and they said 80% of their calls are people calling them saying, I don't know how to plug my car in. Just because people didn't have the knowledge to be able to use the interface to plug the car in. And it's like, oh my God, we've been thinking these are solutions without actually upskilling anyone on how to utilize them.
Wow.
And I've obviously worked on these battery and solar projects before. And the amount of houses and people I go and speak to who have these things fitted, and they've got no idea how they work. And we've given them a day of training on how to operate the systems and how to make the most of them. And they don't utilize it because it's just too confusing. And these non-technical barriers and these systemic issues that you've kind of mentioned there are just the elephant in the room in many ways.
We have all this technology that can be supposedly helpful, but if people are unable to use it or understand how much value it provides, I'm actually surprised about the plugging in your electric car. You know, that seems like a simple one, like how do you plug in your air fryer? How do you plug in your other things in the house? Like, I guess once you plug in the toaster, you leave it in there, huh?
Some of the things you've got as well, it's connected, things like solar panels in the house, and there's a screen on the front of it, and the screen saying certain things about exports and generation numbers. And if you don't know anything about electricity, it just doesn't make any sense. It's not like going to the petrol pump and just chucking petrol in the car. That's pretty straightforward. But actually, some of the smart systems that there are now, they're just a bit confusing. And we might need to scale back to basics if we want to get these things out. Or actually, there needs to be some support. And I don't want to say just from government, because everyone else needs to be involved with it as well, but to enable people to get these skills as we go forward.
It's not unified. The information is not unified. So we've all been immersed for decades, and you put in this leader, you know how much mileage you get. You sort of in your car, you can look up how much mileage you're supposed to get. I can tell because I'm obsessed. I was always obsessed with my petrol and calculating how much I was actually getting per mile of usage. But yeah, that's an easy calculation.
Exactly. And now we've got to work out kilowatt hours. Yeah.
These watts per kilowatt. Yeah, yeah. I remember my husband saying to me, you want to try to get 4 kilowatts per a mile. I am getting about 4.1. So that's good.
I've just got to quickly share something on electric cars before we move on. Because this is amazing and is actually something useful for people if they're ever interested in looking at one. Because you know, you get those miles, like how many miles the car's going to do, and it's all crap. Like, it doesn't really tell you the truth. It's not an accurate representation of how many miles you get.
It's only in the optimal conditions in a laboratory setting. So you're just never going to get the miles, the full range that the factory setting gives you.
Well, I was informed on the weekend at an event I was at about an EV database, and we'll put it in the show notes. And it gives you genuine representations of the mileage you get from an electric car. And it does it in good weather, does it in bad weather, it does it on a motorway, it does it in urban settings. So obviously, sometimes you, like, say you get a car which says 250 miles. If you're doing an urban, mild condition drive, you might get 350 miles out of it. But if you're doing a wet motorway drive, you might only get 170. And it actually gives you the numbers that you need to make your decision. And it's really cool. I just thought I'd share it before I forget.
I definitely use a lot more power when I use the highways. But if I'm more in urban settings, if I take the back country roads and I'm starting and stopping a lot, that really brings it down. And I'm really stoked when I gain miles. And I'm like, yeah.
So, one of the points talked about earlier in passing was the idea of a budget. So an amount of carbon that we could release. And we can estimate roughly what our carbon budget is for 1.5 degrees. So what we mean when we say this, actually, how much carbon can we release into the atmosphere, or greenhouse gases can we release into the atmosphere before we go above 1.5 degrees? And there's all sorts of different ways to analyze this, and there's some complexity around it. But roughly, the idea is that it's somewhere around about 380 billion tons of carbon, with some organizations predicting the number to be more like 260 in terms of actually how much carbon we can release into the atmosphere. And that figure point doesn't mean anything to most people, because you don't know how much carbon we release on a normal basis. But basically, with the way we're going, we will blitz through our 1.5 degree carbon budget within the next 8 to 5 years. So things aren't looking good in terms of keeping warming below that really important threshold of 1.5 degrees. And I think this is the really important bit. If we actually look at the all of the extractable fossil fuel that can be taken out of the ground right now, and this is not including new licenses being issued, this is all the things we have available to us right now, there is 780 billion tons of carbon that will be released. If we just get our extractable fossil fuels, we have things in the ground and where the plans in place already. And something that came out a couple of years ago from the IEA, the International Energy Agency, which is a somewhat conservative in its view of the world group, they said we cannot issue any more oil and gas licenses if we want to keep 1.5 degrees alive. And as I'm sure many of you have seen, this was a 2019 announcement. It's been 4 years since then. We've put quite a few oil and gas licenses out there. So actually, we're not aligned at the moment in terms of keeping 1.5 alive in any way. And we're really whizzing past our carbon budget. The only way people are seeing 1.5 being on the table right now from a scientific perspective is the idea of overshoot and then capture. So we will go past 1.5 degrees for a period of time, and then we'll capture carbon later on, which, as we've kind of said in passing throughout this podcast and throughout the last series, capturing this carbon is not really a feasible thing to do at the moment. Economically, or technically, it is possible, but the cost is just ridiculous. Not saying costs won't come down, because costs come down with technology over time. So obviously things will get cheaper. But the scale at which we need to remove carbon is going to be a really important factor in all of this.
It's pretty massive. You know, so COP27 was last year in Egypt. And during that, there were new licenses and negotiations being hammered out at COP. A lot had to do with the energy crisis and with the war with Russia and Ukraine. But yeah, every year we're continuing to issue more licenses.
With the idea of carbon budgets, there's also debate around how they get split as well, in terms of how we split it across the world. Because we know there's a global figure, but how do we split that across countries? And places like the UK, in my opinion, as a historical emitter, should be doing more to reduce emissions. But there's a big clash in terms of actually looking at climate science and values-based decision-making. And actually, they come back to something that we were talking about earlier in terms of the challenges. Like it's a systemic challenge of actually how we match those two ideologies up.
Yeah, there's a moral hazard there, because there are definitely certain cultures who will need to use more carbon or need to generate more greenhouse gases just to have a better quality of life, where for us, we need to reduce them.
Exactly. There's lots of debate around how we should do carbon budgets. Should they be a historical responsibility, like I kind of said a minute ago? Should it just be a straight per capita basis? Everyone in the world gets the same? Or should it be kind of a bit more nuanced than that? Capacity to decarbonize as well, because some places might be more advanced but actually have very little capacity to decarbonize, whereas some places might be at the beginning of their decarbonization journey or beginning of their development journey, and they could potentially leapfrog some of the technologies if there was the right financial mechanisms to actually give them the support they need. What can we all do to actually make change happen then? Because we obviously realize the gravity of the issue. The challenges we're facing are going to be monumental, and we know that we need systemic change as well, but actually we can do a lot as individuals to actually try and push that forward. So we're recording today's podcast on the 6th of June, and this morning on Radio 4, they had the head of the GMB union on, basically saying let's scrap all of the net zero targets and all of the work we want to do to decarbonize, and they were trying to say that if there was a Labour government in the future that this shouldn't be a priority. But actually, we need to make the people that are in the leadership positions, even in progressive places, realize this is a really, really, really important thing to do. And the rationale that the guy from the GMB gave in all of this is that people don't care. People aren't interested in climate change. But we need to show that it's a fundamental concern of ours that we need to do something on this. And it's not just a wishy-washy thing that sits on the side. It's critical for our futures in general. And reaching out to all sorts of people in leadership positions. We obviously always say to speak to your MP and local councillor, speak to everyone, but in particular, speak to some of the businesses you're involved with as well, or any organisations you buy things from, and say this is important, and get them to lobby people as well. It's only by having this collective approach we'll be able to actually see the transformative change that we need.
And if you're interested in learning more about how to take individual action, check our show notes out and go to takethejump.org. It has all manner of activities, how to do things differently and reduce your carbon footprint.
And it's just generally a cool site as well.
We've now come to the section in our podcast for the quiz. So, Tom, we were talking about the Paris 2015 climate agreement. Who was one of the leading architects of that groundbreaking climate agreement that got those 193 countries to sign on and had to run back and forth, like talking to the Russians? They didn't want something, running back across the hall and getting another group of people to sign, going back and forth and finally getting this done, which actually failed miserably 5 years earlier.
It is our Lord and Savior, Cristiana Figueres, climate goddess.
Ta-da! You should get extra bonus points for that because I didn't even give you my list. Do you want to know my list that you had to choose from?
Go on.
Besides Cristiana, our Lord and Savior, Idris Elba.
Imagine him. It would be intense, wouldn't it?
Al Gore was another one.
Al Gore is a bit of a controversial figure in climate now, though, because a lot of people blame him for the polarization of climate change in America. I feel somewhat unfairly blame him. Obviously, he took it to the political forefront. And as a result, people kind of say, before then, it was a bipartisan issue. Now, after Al Gore, don't like it.
Yeah, I remember that election. I actually worked in Florida, the key state at the time. It was interesting. I would go up to the Capitol at my lunchtime and just look at all the reporters from all over the globe.
There's an amazing podcast miniseries, if you're done with us after starting season two of this, all about that election, and particularly Florida and how he lost it.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. So I lived in Florida at the time, and I worked at the headquarters for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, which was cool because we had our chief biologist, our chief legislators, our chief executives, and our chief law enforcement there. So I was literally less than like a 2-minute walk to the capital of Florida, which is where all of this was, the showdown was happening. It was really great, though, because it meant everybody that I'd ever want to listen to in politics was showing up. And at my lunch, I could just leave. My boss was really cool. I could just leave and go listen to all these fascinating people. But that whole debacle of the hanging chad and recounting the votes went on for so long. It went on into the fall. And in the fall in the United States, American football, college football, is a big deal. And hotel rooms are booked years in advance. So it meant this international community of journalists got kicked out of everyone's houses. And so the public, we had to like take in all these different journalists because the story was still happening. It was a really cool time.
That was an amazing and really interesting tangent.
Yeah, it was really, really cool. So, okay, question number two. Antarctica loses how many tons of ice per year? 100 million? 100 billion? 250 million? 150 billion?
I really hope it's a million. I feel like a billion is a lot of ice.
151 billion tons of ice is lost per year.
That is a fair amount of ice.
It's probably the weight in rock equivalent to the Mount Everest. So, and this is according to NASA's GRACE follow-on satellite, the satellite imagery.
Yeah. And I think we'll be talking about tipping points in one of our future episodes. And you can start to see tipping points in our climate system already, although not officially unlocked. That sounds like it's like an award you get. We're moving towards some worsening impacts and potentially unstoppable impacts. But we'll discuss that in a positive episode about tipping points.
One day we're going to be doing this podcast from our floating raft where we have to like fish for our own food. We've got little hydroponic machine growing our plants to eat. All right. What's the number of people that will be below sea level in 70 years? Or their homes, I should say. 10 million? 50 million, 100 million, or 200 million people whose homes will be underwater in 70 years?
I'm going to go for 50 million. That is awful.
It's 200, my friend.
I was reading a paper a few weeks ago looking at the impact of climate change at 2.7 degrees of warming, which is our projected warming by the end of the century. And that was saying that with that case, one third of the global population will be outside something called the human climate niche. So basically, the climatic conditions which human beings have thrived in historically, And that's with future projections of population growth. So basically, over 3 billion, 3.3 billion people will not live in areas which are currently hospitable. So
that's depressing.
Yeah. And obviously, like living in the UK, there will be impacts, but we won't be impacted anywhere near as much as other places. And that's what's awful about this, is that we can kind of chat about this today, but actually it's other people which are going to feel the brunt of this in so many other ways.
We're going to feel it, but it'll be nothing. We're going to be the lucky ones. So by the end of the century, with global warming, Tom, how many species are at risk of extinction?
God, this is an awful quiz. This is so many negatives.
We will try to have a positive element to the quiz in the future, but don't hold us to it because it's a very serious topic. But okay, at the end of the century in 2100, how many species are set to go extinct at the current rates of warming? 10,000, 25,000, 500,000, or 1 million?
When you think about it, like half a million species seems like a lot of species. I can only name about 12 in my head right now. So I'm gonna go for one of the lower numbers. And I go for option B, please.
25,000, yeah. I think. Yeah, it's a million. By the end of the century, a million species are at risk, including 40% of all amphibians currently known to science, which would be about 3,200 species right there.
The book that actually made me really passionate about this and realized that I wanted to do something around this subject was With the Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Culbert. And that explores the amphibian extinction in quite a lot of detail.
Which is bad. They're part of the ecosystem. We need them.
And they're really cute. I love frogs. They're so cute. Like, as a kid, they are my favorite. I used to go around and say, "Flog, flog, flog."
Thanks for listening to The Ecocentrics. If you listen on Apple and you like what you've heard, then please leave us a review.
And remember to hit follow so you never miss an episode.
If you'd like to get in touch or send us a voice note, our email is hello@theecocentrics.com.
You can also find us on these newfangled social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
And on TikTok as well. So until next week, adios.
Bye.